Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, an aviation academy in Fresno prepares youth from low-income neighborhoods to take to the skies, and how the Omicron variant is impacting everything from our hospitals to the performing arts. But first, last week, Governor Gavin Newsom proposed expanding Medi-Cal to all low-income, undocumented Californians. That would fill a critical gap, as undocumented people ages 27 to 49 don't currently qualify for the health insurance. KVPR's Mathi Bolaños spoke to a Fresno County family who says gaining access to Medi-Cal would be life-changing.
Maria Guadalupe Toledo Mejia is rounding a ball of masa in her hands. She's making baleadas for her husband, Sergio Tulio Arevalo Solis. They're in their apartment in Riverdale, an unincorporated community of nearly 4,000 people in Fresno County. They moved there in 2019 with their three kids, daughter-in-law, and two grandchildren after escaping violence in their home country, Honduras. When they arrived, Sergio says they began working in the fields.
Principalmente en la uva, pero pues...
Primarily picking grapes, he says, but also wherever they'd send them, wherever there's work. But in the last 3 weeks, Lupita and Sergio have been forced to stop working. In late December, 42-year-old Sergio says he was having trouble breathing, so he drove himself to the nearest hospital. He's undocumented and uninsured, but he was able to get Medi-Cal in this emergency situation. The doctors admitted him right away, quickly connecting him to oxygen. After a series of tests, Sergio says his doctors told him he had to have open heart surgery as soon as possible. But Sergio hesitated. He didn't have the money to pay for the surgery. He says he told the doctor if his emergency Medi-Cal didn't cover the surgery, then discharge him and send him home. He'd rather die in his house. Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula says Sergio's experience is a prime example of why the state needs to expand Medi-Cal to all Californians, regardless of immigration status. He represents South and West Fresno County, but before becoming an assemblymember, Arambula was an emergency room doctor in Sanger.
Many people in our immigrant communities are fearful of seeking out health care if they do not have coverage.
He says this has always been the case for undocumented residents, but the pandemic really highlighted the underlying inequities within the state's healthcare system.
It's the absolutely appropriate response for us as a state to take after seeing those disparities is for us to turn around and invest in those very same vulnerable communities to ensure that they have access to healthcare.
The campaign to expand Medi-Cal to all low-income, undocumented residents started nearly a decade ago. The state first expanded Medi-Cal to undocumented kids ages 19 and under in 2016. Undocumented people ages 26 and under got access to the benefits in 2020. And this year, undocumented people ages 50 and older will be able to apply. But as of now, undocumented people between the ages of 27 and 49 still can't get Medi-Cal. So the governor's proposal is the last step towards expanding the health insurance to all Californians. Sarah Darr is with the California Immigrant Policy Center.
Californians have come full circle and embraced this idea that our neighbors and our friends and everybody that's contributing to the social fabric, to the economy of our state, deserves to be taken care of.
Back in Riverdale, Lupita washes her hands before cleaning the wound on Sergio's chest. He ended up getting the heart surgery at a clinic, but Lupita says they still don't know if the procedure was covered by his emergency Medi-Cal.
Igual estamos perdidos, no sabemos qué va a suceder.
They're lost, she says. They don't know if or when they are going to be charged for the follow-up appointments. She says it's all made more difficult by the fact that the medical staff didn't speak or understand Spanish.
Pero mi esposo descargó un
traductor. She says her husband had to download a translating app on his phone so they could communicate with staff. Sergio says if the Medi-Cal expansion is approved, it could be life-changing for many. It would be excellent, he says. Even if it didn't directly benefit him, it will help a lot of people in his similar situation. In the meantime, Lupita says she'll only take off 2 weeks to care for her husband. He'll be in recovery for 5 months, she says, so she needs to get back to work in the fields to support their family of eight. They're both anxiously awaiting the medical bills. For KVPR News, I'm Adi Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. At the Chandler Airport in Southwest Fresno is a nonprofit that is teaching young people from low-income neighborhoods how to soar, literally, in the high-paying aviation industry. I spoke with one of the students in the Next Generation Aviation Academy, 12-year-old Sammy Taylor, along with the organization's founder and president, Joseph Oldham. He started by talking about the nonprofit's early days before the pandemic hit.
Everything was starting to rapidly expand in late 2019, early 2020, and then COVID hit. And so many of our students, you know, just kind of stopped. We continued to figure out ways of safely flying the aircraft that we had access to, even with the COVID restrictions. And then as we came out of COVID in 2021, we continued to kind of move forward to with one or two students that we had on board that were still moving towards getting their private pilot certificate. And then this past summer, we started working with Fresno Unified with their first aviation summer camp, and we had 17 students that were here for that. And then Fresno Unified made a decision that they wanted to move ahead and establish a aviation STEM Academy here at Fresno Chandler, and we became an advisor for them. And then at the same time, one of our students finished up, got his private pilot certificate, and we continued to move forward to slowly get more students. Sammy came in a few months ago, and then we've started steadily adding more students. We initially were looking at private pilot certificate, but as we started talking with Fresno Unified, we realized that they needed a program that would offer training that was more affordable. What we centered up on was getting glider certification. And that would be the lowest cost entry for young people to get into actually flying an aircraft. So that's been our focus now for about the last 4 months, is moving forward to provide glider pilot certification. And we were kind of up against it because we didn't have a motor glider. We wanted to use a motorized self-launching glider for that training. And then the Wood Next Fund through Central Valley Community Foundation provided us this amazing $180,000 donation. And with that, now we're actually able, and we are in the process of acquiring the self-launch motor glider that we need for these students. And now our student numbers are starting to increase, and it's a perfect timing for what we plan to do.
So Sammy, tell me a little bit about your experience in the program. What kinds of stuff have you been doing?
Well, we have been doing a lot of turns, and I've mostly been doing most of my time on the simulation. I've been practicing taking off, staying in the right zones, or keep it on the right course, and turning.
So what's it like? Is it fun?
It is very fun because it's a different experience than a commercial plane, definitely, because the commercial plane's much heavier. but in the smaller planes, it's just like, because they're so much lighter, it's like more enjoyable.
So is this something that was a dream of yours? Or, I mean, did you ever envision yourself flying a plane?
No, I pretty much just thought of it because I said, you know what, I want to do this because I was just doing it on my game because I used to be on my game a lot.
But now that you've had this experience, is this something that you might want to do professionally?
Yes, it is definitely something I'd like to do professionally.
So, Joseph, I would imagine that's part of the objective of this, is to create new opportunities for employment and work for young people in Fresno County.
Absolutely. That is the primary goal of this project, is really to change the trajectory of the young people that are coming up in these neighborhoods or communities where there's been a history of systemic racism, a history of systemic poverty, and a history of systemic isolation from the rest of the world, really, the rest of the economic world. And so that is our primary focus with this, because there is this huge pilot shortage, and there's this huge aviation maintenance technician shortage, and there's really a shortage of aviation professionals in general globally. And certainly that applies here in the United States as well. And so these jobs that are available, if you can get into the industry, are extremely well paying. I mean, the middle median income for an airline pilot is about $130,000, $140,000 a year. You know, maintenance technicians, median income is somewhere around $80,000 a year. Air traffic controllers are about $140,000, $150,000 a year. And so these numbers are really amazing numbers when you compare them with what the median income levels are for jobs that are kind of traditional here in the San Joaquin Valley, which most of those jobs kind of top out at about $50,000 a year. And many of them are way below that, in the $25,000 to $35,000 a year range. So for someone looking to support a family, aviation careers are an outstanding opportunity if they are willing to, you know, go through the training and overcome the barriers, the cost barriers for that training.
So my understanding is that this is a three-phased program so that students at all different age groups can participate. Can you talk a little bit about those three tiers? And I understand, so Sammy's part of that first tier of students, is that right?
Correct. Yeah. So we're constrained by the Federal Aviation Administration regulations on the minimum age for students to do certain things. The minimum age for glider pilot certification is 16, but a student can solo a glider at 14. So Sammy is right now 12, and he's turning 13 in April. And that's a really good time to get him started in actual training where he's logging hours. What we're doing with Sammy right now is providing him with flight experiences. In other words, he basically goes along as a passenger with myself or other pilots that are part of our New Vision Aviation Club and gets experience flying in aircraft, small aircraft. He gets a chance to handle the controls. He can't log the time towards his certification, but it's great experience for him. And then when he turns 13, we'll actively start training him in this motorized glider that we're acquiring and moving him towards his actual certification. In the meantime, we can also provide him with drone pilot certification, and that's not constrained by age. So we can start some of these students, if they're so inclined, we can get them flying drones and get them certified as a drone pilot, even as young as 10 or 12 years old. So that's part of phase one, looking at drone certifications and then glider certification. And then as they get older, getting them prepared to enter into the Fresno Unified or other districts' STEM aviation education programs. And then by the time they graduate from high school, we will have them prepared to, so they actually know how to fly an aircraft and are interested in moving forward in an aviation career. And then Reedley College offers a two-year flight science degree program that'll take them up through their instructor rating, so they can get their commercial and their instrument and their certified flight instructor rating with Reedley College.
So, Sammy, you know, I would imagine most 12-year-olds in Fresno County have never been in an airplane, and you've actually been able to handle the controls of one. What is it like to fly over your home?
You kind of just feel like you're free. Like, you're pretty much, there's endless possibilities of what you can do up there.
And how does that experience change how you feel about your life when you're on the ground?
You definitely feel bored when you're down here.
So then I would imagine you're pretty excited to move into the next phase of the training.
Yes, I'm very excited.
What are your thoughts about taking it to the next step and actually, you know, moving toward, you know, logging your own hours and moving toward certification?
Well, I'm very excited about it because, well, I just want to make money so I can get a car.
What kind of car do you want?
A 2004 Mustang Cobra SVT Terminator Edition.
I like the specificity. That's awesome. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I've been talking with Joseph Oldham, president and founder of New Vision Aviation, and Sammy Taylor, a Next Generation Aviation Academy student. Thank you both so much for being on the program.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Appreciate the opportunity as well.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Thanks to the Omicron variant, more new COVID cases are being reported in the Valley than at any other time during the pandemic. And even though the variant is less severe than previous ones, the sheer number of cases means hospitals are still being overwhelmed, including children's hospitals. To get a clearer picture of COVID among local kids, KVPR's Carrie Klein spoke with Dr. Niall Mason, Medical Director of Infectious Disease at Valley Children's Hospital in Madera.
When COVID started nearly 2 years ago now, it was the disease of the elderly. Most of the hospitalization, most of the cases were in senior homes, were in older individuals. That's not the case with these two past peaks or surges that we've seen with COVID, the Delta surge and now the Omicron surge. These are young adults and pediatric surges more so than others. In fact, if you look at the CDC dashboard for cases of COVID, you see that the number of cases seen in children is actually more than the number of cases that's being detected and reported in individuals 65 years of age and older.
So what is the outlook right now at Valley Children's for the number of kids who are being hospitalized for COVID-19?
During the month of December, it was a relatively quiet time for us from COVID standpoint. We were seeing a lot of the other respiratory viruses that we typically see in the fall and the winter. So things like RSV, for example, which is another respiratory virus that affects children and can lead to what we call bronchiolitis, which is inflammation of the small airways in the lungs. However, toward the end of December, beginning of January, right after the holidays, we saw, like the rest of the nation did, a rapid spike in the cases of COVID-19. So our positivity rate jumped from around 3% in December to around 30% within the first 2 weeks of January. That means in the emergency room department here, almost every third child that got tested for COVID returned with a positive result. Luckily, what we're seeing is that most of these cases have been mild. Most of these children were able to be treated in the emergency room and then discharged home from there. However, some of them that were not as fortunate, some of them did need to come into the hospital. So our hospitalization rate also increased. I believe last week we had 12 children that were admitted to the hospital because of COVID. Some of them I saw personally were in the intensive care unit requiring oxygen support. What seems like in terms of this particular spike is that the severity of illness is less than the prior variants, the prior spikes that we've seen with COVID, the most recent one being the Delta spike that we saw during the summertime. That one was more contagious than before, was relatively more severe in terms of the presentation. It was also affecting children more so than prior spikes. This particular one, Omicron, is more contagious but less severe. But again, when you look at the sheer numbers, you see that out of these many cases that you see, naturally, some of them would have some risk factors to have a severe disease and would require hospital admission and would require ICU admission. That comes actually in a time where we're already inundated by high census in terms of our patients in general, because this year, as I said, has been a bad year for RSV, which is another respiratory virus, as I mentioned earlier. And we're also starting to see a spike of influenza cases as well. The other factor that's making things challenging for us and also for the rest of the hospitals in the area, perhaps in the country in general, is that many of the staff members also have been either exposed or infected with COVID. And because of that, they had to be excused from work until they're done with either their isolation or their quarantine period. And that was adding also more challenges to how well hospitals in the area have been able to care for patients with COVID or with other conditions.
So of the children that have been admitted to Valley Children's and either tested positive there or have been admitted to the ICU or otherwise or have severe complications from the virus, are they largely vaccinated or not? Or do you have any idea for that?
I do. So again, the cases that I saw last week when I was rounding on patients in the ICU and also on the hospital floor with COVID were all in the unvaccinated individuals. And many of those were actually eligible to receive the vaccine, but unfortunately, for one reason or the other, did not get their vaccination. The data on the effect of the vaccination on hospital admission and ICU admission is very obvious. The vaccination helps as a protective factor against hospital admission, against ICU admission, and against death. When you look at the rates of these complications of COVID, again, ICU admission or death, it's obvious that the vaccine is a very protective factor. It's obvious that the risk factor for needing hospital admission or dying from COVID is much higher in individuals who are unvaccinated compared to those who completed the series of the vaccine, including the booster.
So recently, the federal government has committed to providing rapid antigen tests for all households in the U.S. This following many weeks, even months, of low supply of those test kits in pharmacies. But at the same time, as you said, this is flu season, and there's a high incidence of flu and RSV among children. So for parents who have kids who are showing some sort of respiratory symptom, what do you recommend is the course of action to rule out COVID and then perhaps try and, you know, figure out if they have one of these other viruses?
I think there are several important points to make about this question. The first one is someone has symptoms, period, regardless of the cause, it is best for them to stay home. Because whether this is influenza, RSV, or COVID, you do not want to expose people around you to any of these infections. And that does apply to children. All of these three viruses can actually lead to complications in children, just like they do in adults. So be careful from that standpoint. Now, the best use for the home kits, the rapid antigen test, is probably in someone who is asymptomatic. So if someone is asymptomatic and they're planning to go into a gathering, it's probably a good idea to get that test done before they go into that event or into that gathering. If someone is symptomatic, regardless of the test result, positive or negative, they should try their best to stay away from any large gathering. They try their best to isolate until their symptoms resolve.
So much of this is a story that we've heard before, that the patients being admitted to hospitals, you know, with the most severe disease are largely unvaccinated. Plus, more staff members have COVID than ever before. There are more patients in beds than ever before. So how is morale among you and your colleagues, you know, as you see history repeating itself throughout this pandemic?
I think there is a lot of resilience among the healthcare staff. Again, this is our second year going into the third year of dealing with COVID, but still, I believe the morale among the staff has been very, very high, despite all the challenges. I see that among my colleagues, doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, everyone in the hospital. Despite all the challenges, everyone is still willing to bring their best. Everyone is still willing to do everything they can to care for patients. What is somewhat challenging is when you have to stay home because you're either exposed or you're sick, even if you're feeling okay, if someone is positive as a healthcare member, you can't just show up to work. You have to finish your isolation period so you don't expose patients, you don't expose others around you.
And so what do you hope can be learned from this latest crisis, this Omicron crisis, you know, in the event that we encounter yet another highly contagious variant? What do you hope that we can learn from this one?
I hope that we can learn that this is something that we need to live with, that every major spike of COVID that we deal with, it feels like at the end of it, everyone starts celebrating too early and thinking that, yes, it's over, it's done. Let's let go of all of our armors, everything that all the measures that we're taking to prevent infection. And I don't think that's the right thing to do. I think we need to be smarter about how we deal with this. It's obvious how many hills and valleys, maybe we should call it instead of peaks and spikes. And it's obvious how many we dealt with and how many we'll likely deal with in the future. So rather of letting go of all of these protective measures, I think we need to be smart into how much we allow. I think this should highlight the importance of the vaccination. A lot of people think of the vaccine as a switch, as a binary thing. It's either 100% protective or 0% protective. What I like to tell people around me is that think about it more like a dial. Getting the vaccine will just dial down the chances of getting the infection, will dial down the chances of getting complications from the infection. It's not necessarily 100% guarantee against getting the infection. Similarly with wearing a mask, staying away from a large social gathering, staying away from a crowded area, especially indoors, all of these things are measures that work together to dial down the chances of getting the infection or getting too sick because of it. Nothing is 100% guarantee. So we have to be smart about complying with these measures and know when we can let go of some of them and continue to be compliant with the rest.
Right. Well, Dr. Niall Mason, Valley Children's Director of Infection Prevention and Infectious Disease, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I appreciate you too.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The United Farm Workers is among the most high-profile unions in the state, despite a decades-long struggle to grow its ranks. To get a better sense of the challenge to recruit members, I spoke with Philip Martin, UC Davis Professor Emeritus of Agricultural and Resource Economics.
So the United Farm Workers is such an iconic organization, I mean, throughout the country, but particularly here in California. But can you give us a sense of how many workers actually belong to the union?
All unions have to report their membership and their income and expenditures every year to the Department of Labor. And the last report that I looked at was for 2018. And then the UFW reported 8,700 active and retired members. So about 7,000 active members, 1,700 retirees.
How does that relate to the overall size of agricultural workers in the state?
Well, we have an average of about 425,000 workers. So that's an average. In the summer, it's higher. It's 550 or so thousand workers. In the winter, it's lower. So average employment is about 425,000. But because of seasonality and turnover, there's about twice as many unique workers who are employed for wages in agriculture sometime during the year than there are jobs. So we have about 850,000 unique workers. And if we give the UFW 8,500, then roughly speaking, we've got 1% of California farm workers who would be employed sometime during the year under a union contract. I should clarify that the UFW represents workers who tend to be employed longer periods. So not short season workers who may work for a labor contractor and perhaps only work 3 or 4 months of the year. The commodity that's most unionized by the UFW is mushrooms, fresh mushrooms. And the mushroom workers tend to be employed year round. and earn relatively high wages.
I do want to, you know, make it clear that representatives from the UFW argue that union membership is not really the most meaningful metric to determine their success. They say that they are focused on advocacy, and certainly they have been very successful in bringing about meaningful reforms. What do you say to that response to this critique?
Well, it is true that unions in the past looked at their members as kind of their customers, because after all, the union is offering a service, helping to give workers a voice in the workplace, a grievance mechanism, as well as winning for them higher wages and better benefits. And in turn, workers pay dues of 2 or 3% of their wages to the union. So it's, in a sense, a service business. What has happened over time is that unionization in agriculture and outside of agriculture has decreased significantly as manufacturing shrank. And so now we have more unionized public sector workers than we have private sector workers, even though most people in the United States are employed in the private sector and almost all farm workers are employed in the private sector. So not just the United Farm Workers Union, so have many other unions said that you can't look at their impacts only in workplaces where they represent workers. You have to look at their broader efforts to reduce inequality in the United States, to raise minimum wages, et cetera. And that's, so many unions are saying you have to look at our broader impacts on government policies and what we do for workers, not narrowly what we do for workers in a particular workplace where there's a union contract.
Well, let's go ahead and come back to this question of wages. What does the research say about the relationship between wages for agricultural workers who belong to a union versus those who do not?
Well, the short answer is we have no good data on that. The main problem that we have is the United States Department of Labor does not interview farm employers. It only interviews non-farm employers. So when we go and look at the so-called union wage premium, which the Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates every year, we find that workers represented by unions in the non-farm sector earn between 15 and 20% on average more than workers who are not represented by unions. We do not have any kind of similar data in agriculture because the Department of Labor does not collect data from farm employers, and employers typically provide the cost of wages and the cost of benefits. What we do know is that if we compare workers employed on, let's say, UFW-represented farms to workers on non-union farms, the UFW-represented workers typically have maybe not higher wages, but they do typically have more benefits. They do typically have paid vacations, paid holidays. The union has a healthcare plan, the Robert F. Kennedy healthcare plan, that is included in many of the contracts. There's a pension plan that's included in many of the UFW contracts. So the biggest difference in California agriculture between UFW represented and non-UFW represented farm workers is often in benefits rather than in wages.
What makes it so difficult to organize workers?
Well, you could have many long sessions on this. In fact, I just got a three-day program agenda, which says, why is it so hard for unions to organize workers?
Unfortunately, we don't have 3 days.
Sorry. And I think at the end of 3 days, people would still disagree.
Okay.
There's a whole lot of reasons that are cited, including the fact that many of the things that unions fought for and won are now provided as a matter of either government mandate, so that you have to provide health insurance to workers if you're of a certain size. They're provided, there is Social Security, which there didn't used to be. There are minimum wages. There is overtime pay for farm workers. So one argument is that the extra value added from unions is just not there enough for unions to attract new members. So that was the argument about Amazon in Alabama recently, that workers couldn't see what more they were going to get. The other argument, of course, is that employers hire consultants in order to persuade workers not to support unions. So it's a complex web of a lot of things, but it's not just in agriculture. I mean, unionization has always been difficult in agriculture, and it has to do with the characteristics of the workers, often little education, often not speaking English. But perhaps, to my mind, one of the most important things is most farm workers think of farm work as a job, not a career. They would like to find something better. And most farm workers that I've interviewed would like their children to get an education and not follow them into the fields. So if you have an industry that's kind of a revolving door industry, people come in and they work in the industry until they can get a better option, then it is really difficult to persuade workers that, yes, you should organize, pay dues to a union, and we will make your job a career, because most workers are not entering, especially seasonal farm work, with that in mind. So that's what makes it so hard to organize unions at McDonald's or any sector in which there is high turnover of workers and relatively few workers who stay with the job for an entire career.
Well, I've been talking with Philip Martin, UC Davis Professor Emeritus of Agricultural and Resource Economics. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Local arts critic Donald Monroe recently released his annual list of the top 20 cultural events of 2021, a year that proved to be a challenging one for the performing arts. I spoke with Monroe to learn more about how artists overcame the pandemic last year and what the latest wave of Omicron means for the future.
You've been publishing this annual top 20 list, for years, going back to your time with the Fresno Bee. And this might be a totally impossible question for you to answer, but looking back, how did the art and culture scene in 2021 compare to previous years?
Well, I do have to describe it as sort of like the way you would with a sports records or sports statistics it's a year with an asterisk, because there were only essentially a few months that things were so-called back to normal,
right,
in terms of the performing arts. So, I debated about whether to cut down the list, the number of things that I chose, or to not even do it. But I thought, I'll just go ahead and use the material that I had. And surprisingly, it was still hard for me to narrow down those last few spots.
Well, let's dive into the list itself. What were some of the highlights of last year?
Well, I usually pick one sort of top event to kind of highlight. And this year, I picked an actor, Sean Williams, who is very well known to patrons of Good Company Players. He has been in just a scad of shows, and you might have last seen him perform in Elf, the musical, which he played the title role and was just a dynamo in that part. He also played in a very different kind of show for Good Company that was called Daddy Long Legs. And that was a musical that played during the summer. And that was just a two-person show. And to have a two-person musical that goes for 2 hours. That's a real heavy lift right there. And he was wonderful in that role. And so, you know, it's kind of like a body of work thing as well. So he has been so consistent, so energetic, so good in his roles at Good Company that I just made him my number one.
And I'd imagine there were some pretty creative artistic expressions on the list, just given the limitations of the year. I mean, I know there was some Zoom events on the list, some events from the Rogue Festival. Maybe you could highlight a couple more.
Yeah, so Fresno City College did a production that was Zoom that was called The Line. And The Line was about healthcare workers battling COVID-19 in New York City. And it's one of those documentary style plays where the playwrights go out and interview people and then sort of fashion a play from their words. So it is, I guess you would say it's like a nonfiction play, but with some creative shaping. And so what City College did is they sent out equipment to all their students, lights, everything, and they all filmed their roles from their individual homes. And then it was all edited together. And it was one of the best Zoom productions that I ended up seeing during the pandemic. I thought it was really, really strong. And another innovative show was Matilda, which was performed by Children's Musical Theater Works. And this was a live production, but it had I joked that it had a gestation period as long as a human being. It was in rehearsals for 9 months because they kept postponing it because of COVID. And they rehearsed in tiny little pods. So usually there were 2 to 4 cast members who'd be rehearsing at a time. And it was a logistical nightmare to get all of these kids together on stage, but they did it. And it was so wonderful to see those kids up there. They were wearing face shields, but to see those kids on stage performing.
So readers of the Monroe Review will know that most of your recent articles have unfortunately been about cancellations. Can you give us a sense of how this wave of Omicron is impacting the local art scene?
It's been tough. The Fresno Philharmonic canceled its January Masterworks concert and decided they would not try to postpone it. They just went straight ahead and canceled it. The theater companies have been playing a postponement game. And so Good Company Players had to postpone its opening of Guys and Dolls. As of the time we're talking, we think that that's going to be opening on this week, but it's still kind of a guess. And the reason is because so many people are calling out sick and they don't have enough understudies to be able to cover the roles. So Good Company went ahead and did that. And I am told, I don't think an official announcement has been made yet, but Selma Arts Center is postponing its production of SpongeBob SquarePants, which was supposed to open the 21st, and they hope that they're going to be able to open that the 28th. And the idea is that just if you postpone it a week, that maybe this Omicron thing will sort of settle down a little, and the people who are having to quarantine because of positive tests will be able to come back and fill their roles.
Well, let's try to end on a more optimistic note. We have a whole year ahead of us of cultural events. What are you excited about? What should we be paying attention to?
Well, the biggest deal is going to be Hamilton. We are getting Hamilton the musical, the national tour, the one that has been going all over the country, and that opens on March 30th. And placed through April 10th. And I think that will be a really exciting moment for Fresno. Crossing fingers, do all the things that you can do to hope that things get back a little bit more to normal. But that's a huge show. And I think that it will welcome a lot of people back to the Sorrento Theater. And I think it'll just feel like a very, hopefully feel like a normal thing. And so that's one of my big hopes. There is some great stuff that's gonna be happening on the art scene, visual art scene, the Fresno Art Museum, as part of this big grant that was given by the McClatchy Fresno Arts Foundation. It's going to be opening of a blockbuster exhibition in the summer, and the same with Arte Americas. And so I think that those are two arts events to really look forward to.
Well, I've been talking with Donald Monroe, editor of the Monroe Review. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last year, KVPR led StoryCorps' One Small Step project locally, giving San Joaquin Valley residents with different political views a chance to converse and listen to each other. This year, StoryCorps itself is continuing the One Small Step project in Fresno. In this One Small Step segment, we feature Deanna and Carol. Deanna is an African-American trans woman who has struggled with addiction, is nearly 4 years sober, and currently works in academia. Carol is an Armenian-American retired speech therapist who recently lost her husband. They talk about the struggles they've overcome and how they want to be remembered. They begin with a conversation about Deanna's transition.
I wonder how many trans people I've already met without even knowing it. Because, you know, who knows?
Right. I think that's interesting that you say that, because when I find myself in conversations and we're talking about trans people, there's issues about the bathroom usage. There's all these different things that are political. But I navigate through the universe and no one knows that I'm transgender. It's not stealth. It's not that's not what we're doing. It's
no.
We're just living our lives.
Right,
and
right.
I think that it was a gift for me to be trans, mm-hmm. That it is a blessing. Because I've lived over 25 years of my life male. Mm-hmm. And now I have to have this experience of learning and operating and navigating the universe as a female.
Mm-hmm.
Once I made that decision, the world opened up to me.
Right.
But I do have two perspectives.
And sure you do.
So,
yeah.
So that's fascinating.
Yeah.
To me, all the time, I'm blown away.
Deanna, this has been a real journey for you.
Yes, it has been. It has been.
Are you feeling better about yourself than you ever have at any other point in your life? It sounds like that.
Yes, and to be honest with you, before my act of addiction, I was always asking and praying to my higher power to enlighten me. I now look at my addiction because it has broken me open, and it has really, I have a much stronger relationship with all the things in my life, all the things in existence, as well as my higher power. Sometimes I wonder if that was the enlightenment that showed up for me, and it just showed up in a way I didn't know. So to answer your question, it has been a journey, but I'm in a much better place than I have ever been in my life, and I have a deeper appreciation for all of the things in life.
Is every day a gift to you?
Every day is a gift.
Yeah.
And I get it.
Yes.
I get it.
Yes.
I get it.
That's great.
Could you briefly describe, in your own words, your personal political values?
Oh, my Lord. Well, they have been evolving quite a bit over the past 10 years, easily. It was interesting. I mean, when I first registered to vote, I was an independent.
Okay.
And then I think I switched to Republican after about 5 or 6 years. My family was, my husband was, and I go, yeah, whatever. Am I conservative anymore? I don't know. I think I'm more moderate than conservative, and I've become more liberal in a lot of things. I don't know what I am. I'm changing. I guess that's the best way of saying it. I'm changing.
You mentioned that your husband and your family were Republican.
Yes.
Conservative. And you said that you were widowed, so your husband recently...
Yes.
Passed away. So do you think that gave you space to choose your own way as compared to the influence that you have with someone who is your partner?
Mm-hmm. I was heading in that direction anyway, but I do think you're right, Deanna. I think when something really life-changing like that happens to you, you break down or you break open, as you say.
Yes, absolutely.
And It's very liberating to have something horrible happen to you and to come through it. I am more me, I guess you could say, now. Okay. And I was heading that way anyway, but I think my husband's death kind of gave me a little turbocharge there. Okay. What about your personal political values, Deanna? Tell me.
I would definitely identify as a liberal. I'm a very liberal person. But as I have matured, I've become much more independent. I can't say a party represents me completely. It just doesn't happen. I have rather conservative views on certain things, mm-hmm. and then on other things, I'm very, very liberal. One of the things I'm working with spiritually is to recognize that againstness doesn't work spiritually, and it doesn't connect. It just doesn't work for the universe. So when I read your bio, my first thought was, I wonder why she chooses to go outside of her box or outside of her world to expand. I would think that being a woman with a family, you probably fit the status quo in a lot of areas.
I do.
You know, there's probably safety in not knowing.
Yes, too, there is.
Right?
You're absolutely right. Because change can threaten people.
Right.
Right. My answer to that is, why not? What an opportunity. Why not? You only live once. Mm-hmm. Why not meet someone new? Why not hear a different perspective? Why not affirm what I already believe, that we're more alike than different? That is so important. Why would I hold back? I love people. I love talking to people. I love hearing their stories. And more than anything, I want people to see each other as human beings.
How would you like to be remembered?
Well, I hope my kids love me. And my grandkids. That's about it. What about you?
I would like to be remembered as someone who loved unconditionally, and someone who, whenever it was needed, was there, who was present, and who made a difference, even the smallest difference, for anyone who needed. I would like to be remembered that way. Maybe a little fashionable, too. You know, she always looked good. I like that.
That was Deanna and Carol, One Small Step conversation partners at Woodward Park Library in Fresno. And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Mathi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.